You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Today,
we come out here and try to do everything we can to provide you and the American people with what he's doing on their behalf. And yet we see time and time again an attempt to parse every little word and make it more of a game of gotcha.
Gonzo leaves The Muppet Show. My guests Carlotta Ribello, Chiara Ramella and Chris Lord will be discussing Sean Spicer's departure and the day's other top stories, including Germany's rethinking of whether it and Turkey are really still friends, Indonesia's rethinking of where it wants its capital, and we'll reveal what a social hyperlocal multi-passenger pooled vehicle actually is. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Chiara Ramella, Carlotta Ribello and Chris Lord. Welcome all. We will start tonight by looking at Turkey. As generations of hack travel writers have enjoyed pointing out, it is the proverbial land of contrasts, but has become more so in recent years. Turkey is nominally a Western ally, a member in good standing of NATO, and as we were hysterically reminded during last year's referendum campaign in the UK, a candidate for EU membership. In recent years, however, Turkey has not always acted like a friend to or part of the West, and now Germany is overhauling its policy in favour of a harder line. Chris, until very recently, our Istanbul bureau chief, Germany is going to issue new travel advisories, speak up more about imprisoned journalists, human rights activists, of which there are many, including German citizens. Is this Germany acknowledging reality? Are we losing Turkey?
I think so. I think this is a significant change. And just to give a bit of background about why this travel advisory is coming in. First of all, just a week ago, Peter Steutner, a German human rights activist, was detained in Turkey along with a whole host of other human rights activists. And, you know, you've got to remember Turkey is a country where you've got hundreds of journalists in jail. You've got a mass purge of civil society that's still ongoing. People being put into prison, people losing their jobs, tens of thousands of people. It's a astonishingly changed place than it was even just a year ago from when the coup happened. So the question of, is this a significant change? When Sigmar Gabriel, the foreign minister of Germany, says, we're going to put a travel advisory on, warning tourists, of which, let's be fair, there's probably not that many of them going to be going to Turkey this year, but warning them away from going there, and more importantly, advising business leaders to avoid the country, to avoid going there and investing there, that is a major thing. Because if you comes back to that president in Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has always said, I am a man of business. I am someone who can make sure you can do business better, you can export, and of course, the second biggest market for Turkish goods is Germany. And as soon as you start disrupting that, that's when it's going to hit Turkey very hard.
Carlotta, Germany's foreign minister, who Chris just mentioned, Sigmar Gabriel, has also said of Turkey that it takes two to tango, therefore suggesting that Turkey does need to sort itself out a bit if it wants to be seen as an economic, diplomatic partner of the West, etc. Has the West been allowing Turkey to get away with too much?
I think so. And, you know, in terms of the EU, there's an angle here that it's worth bearing in mind, which is the refugee deal that was made with Turkey at the peak of the refugees crisis, and it managed to somehow control the numbers of the influx of refugees arriving to Europe's borders, and that's what has been keeping the EU so quiet, in my opinion. I think if it had been any other state already member of the EU, the reaction would have been much quicker. We only need to look at Poland, what's happening now, and the EU is already considering action. So I think ever since the failed coup in Turkey, it has been a shift away from Europe, without a doubt. And the fact that still there's question about Turkey's eventual membership of the European Union, it's completely, I can't understand that. And we need to remember that since that coup, the number of Turkish, well, refugees, essentially, asylum seekers, call it what you want, going to Germany has risen. So there's a lot at stake here.
Chiara, is there a difficulty here with perhaps, I mean, what, even though Sigmar Gabriel and Germany generally probably have a bunch of fairly reasonable points here, is the trouble not that this actually entrenches Erdogan further by playing into his hold, it's us against the world narrative?
Of course, but everything is always going to do that if people are going to take a stance against him. He's already done so today. He's already retorted, saying that actually Germany's attitude towards its own way of looking at justice is worse than Turkey. I don't think that that should be an element of dissuasion from trying to stand up to him, because I think you can't really expect him not to.
Chris, you know, are we making a mistake in still thinking of Turkey, for all that it is, as we discussed, a NATO member, in theory at least, EU candidate, although I suspect Turkey will have men on Mars before it joins the EU. Do we need to start thinking of it as a, I don't know, what would you call it, a semi-rogue state, somewhere like Iran or Russia? Or is it at least do we have to deal with the possibility that that's the direction in which it is heading?
Do you know, the very sad, and I understand what you're saying, Andrew, the very sad reality of it is that what we're actually talking about is, in all those cases, you know, heading towards a rogue state, no longer the same ally we always thought it was. It's not Turkey, it's Erdogan's Turkey that is
well,
that.
Indeed, yes.
And I think what I'm trying to say there is that you have a country that's basically being held hostage by a certain ideological viewpoint and a one leader. I mean, it's Turkey looks ahead to that general election in 2019. It's going to have one man rule, essentially, when those new powers come in. And we're going to face a situation whereby it's only going to get worse. Now, as I think one important point to make about this story, about the whole travel advisories and so on, is that throughout the last years, as Carlotta mentioned, this refugee deal that the EU did with Turkey to stem the flow of migrants across the Aegean Sea, so many people inside Turkey who do not identify with Erdogan's Turkey, who are, for whatever we want to call them, oppositional journalists, oppositional leaders and so on, said it was a dirty deal. Because it was a justification that the Erdogan government is still a viable partner to deal with. When you start actually cutting them off and saying, well, actually, you know what? We're not going to do business with you. We're not going to make it easy for our investment to go there. And we're not even going to put our tourist dollars with you anymore. We're going to cut you off. That is so powerful. And as I say, I'm glad to see, finally, Germany actually grabbing the book and doing something with it.
And there's another interesting angle here as well, is that Germany is threatening as well to review all applications for arms projects. And we need to remember, this is big business between these two nations. Just last year, Germany exported around 84 million euros worth of armaments to Turkey. So also questioning these applications and what's going to happen to the arms exports, it means a lot for the country. Now, I think that what this means for now is that the Federal Office for Economics and Export Control won't cancel applications already being processed, but just simply won't accept new ones. But we're in the middle of the year. There's a lot that could happen. And just shortly, going back to Sigmar Gabriel's statements, there was something that I picked up on it that I thought it was quite interesting, which was that he mentioned that for the past couple of months, Berlin has been trying to restart relations with Turkey, to hit, you know, a restart button, let's move this forward. And they have been repeatedly disappointed. This is a quote from Sigmar Gabriel, and that basically they just refused to move on, to move this relationship elsewhere. So it really begs the question, what else could Germany do?
And finally, I just want on that point, and I agree with exactly what Carlotta is saying. I think also as well, we've got to remember, geopolitically, things are changing over there in the Middle East. ISIS is collapsing. The fight again in Mosul, the fight in Raqqa, it is going against ISIS. So those bases, of which Germany right now is moving its armed forces out of Incirlik, the sort of importance of Turkey as this NATO flank on the east is not quite as important as it was 12 months ago. And leaders need to acknowledge that and change their policies accordingly.
OK, well, let's now, with no grinding of gears whatsoever, contemplate two possible visions for the future of public transport. Here in London, the City Mapper app has been given permission for a 6-month trial of a night route from Aldgate to Highbury for what it calls a social hyperlocal multi-passenger pooled vehicle. This appears to translate as bus, but with the attraction of geo-matching technology, whatever that is, which will minimise wait times and maximise capacity. Much more dramatically, in the US, the billionaire boffin Elon Musk claims to have acquired permission to build his Hyperloop tunnel from Washington, D.C. to New York. The US government claims otherwise, but still. Kiara, first of all, this City Mapper thing first, its social hyperlocal multi-passenger pooled vehicle.
Indeed.
It is lovely, isn't it?
I'm so catchy.
I'm not going to get tired of saying it. The there should be a sort of a jingle with that. As a, you can imagine the ad, it's a social hyper... Yeah, it has a certain poetry to it. It's basically a night bus, isn't it, Chiara?
Yes, of course. And us who live in London know the poetry and the, you know, forever... I mean, the nostalgia that some of us have because now the night tube has swept in and kind of cancelled the need for us to take the night bus.
Nostalgia is one word for it.
No, I think the City Mapper initiative is actually very interesting in as much as I think it is quite a successful way of translating something that lives in the virtual realm into something that's practical and, if well organized and if the data is harvested correctly, quite possibly very useful.
Now, back in May, City Mapper launched the first attempt at this. It was what they called a smart bus, so not as complicated as the new name now.
It wasn't a smart social hyperlocal multi-passenger pooled vehicle.
It was just a smart bus. I don't know what changed
evolved,
in the meantime.
Of course.
But it was smaller because they argued that you don't need buses as big to travel the city. You increase the frequency, but that would permit that there's not as many traffic jams, etc. It was free because they could, if they wanted to charge people, they had to apply for the TfL license, which is what they did. And I went on that bus for that experiment. It went on a loop around Blackfriars to Waterloo, more or less, and went on a loop, had USB plugs inside, was all green inside and outside, had smart screens that I guess used the data that told them that was a good stretch for them to do this tryout. So this is an obvious second step after that, because, you know, it was funny those 2 days that they run that experiment. In the beginning, like, I saw that being reported, and everyone was basically saying, oh, it's just journalists and City Mapper stuff, and that's it. But then, by the time I got there in the afternoon, actually, there were a lot of people using that. And they did the same as here. They found a gap in the route that is not serviced by TfL transport, and they decided to fill that gap. And now in the evening, they're doing the same thing. Hopefully, if their use of smart data, which is a word everyone likes to float around, is done properly, that will mean that no longer you have to wait for 25 minutes for a bus, or three if they come at the same time, and decide to take a cab or an Uber instead. So I also think there's an aspect here about what it does for branding for transit, because, you know, in London you only see the double deckers that you've seen all the time, and having someone coming into the fold, does that mean that in the future you'll have more similar companies? Will that change transit branding in the future? I think I personally find that interesting.
I mean, it is true what they say, that you wait all day and then three social hyperlocal multi-passenger vehicles turn up at once. Chris, if we could look at something slightly more futuristic and possibly more exciting, this is Elon Musk, I think, indulging in a bit of hype generation for his Hyperloop. No permission appears to have been extended at all for him to build a big tunnel between New York and Washington, D.C. Do we like this idea if he can get it to work? Would you be willing to be whisked through a tunnel at 1,200 kilometres an hour in order to travel between New York and Washington, D.C. in, I think, 29 minutes, they're saying?
I mean, it does sound amazing, Andrew. I have to say one thing. My sort of personal or relative experience of Hyperloop is that over in Dubai, they've been going on for so long about building a Hyperloop, an Elon Musk Hyperloop, I should say, from Dubai to Abu Dhabi. But what that has also mean is that the traffic between Dubai and Abu Dhabi, they've not had to deal with, because they say, one day the Hyperloop will come and this will fix all of our problems. Now, that was several years ago that was announced, and still there's no Hyperloop, and still we don't know if it works. And this is kind of my problem, is that Hyperloop has become a sort of way, certainly in situations like this. I mean, you know, NYC to Washington, D.C. is a bit of a different thing, but I think certainly become a way to sort of not have to actually deal head-on with certain issues. You know, what... Not to sound sort of a Luddite about it, but sometimes, you know, what's wrong with just laying a bit of rolling stock, getting a track out there and getting a straightforward, you know, train system on the go? Do we need to be always waiting for this essentially speculative technology, which if you look by this story for Elon Musk, we still don't know it's worked, and he's going around telling people he's got approvals for it.
Should we build another runway at Heathrow when someone's just going to invent the teleport?
Wow, that's a very good question. That's exactly it. And that, you know, this comes back to it. I just think it's sometimes become a little bit of a way for governments, certainly, as I say, in the Middle East, to avoid having to face the actual reality of building a real transport network.
And with this Hyperloop, it is still all, you know, very in terms of theory only. We still haven't seen one single working model of how this would look. Or we know the people working on the team developing the theory that would make, you know, traveling through vacuum possible. But we haven't seen how it would actually work. And, you know, I quite like the idea that you can get verbal approval for a project that involves interstate transit.
Well, from this White House, you probably can, in fairness. Kiara, final thought on this. The thing is that these things will happen. Somebody will crack it. Technology will improve. There will be enormous leaps forward of the same that there were with the, you know, the passenger jet aircraft, etc., etc., etc. But do we reach a point at which any amount of speed is an indulgence? Do we need to be able to travel between New York and Washington in 29 minutes?
Well, you're speaking to a person who genuinely finds travelators quite unnerving. So, so I do think that 1,200 kilometres an hour is a number that I probably...
On a travelator, you'd need to hold on pretty tight.
I think I would, probably. I appreciate the bullet train, but I think there is a point where if the improvement that a super high speed project brings is not parallel or commensurate to the amount of disruption and the amount of just simple investment that is put into it, then maybe at some point we just need to put the brakes on it.
Well, this is, of course, a country which is in the process of spending several billion pounds in order to make it slightly quicker to get to Birmingham, which is the logic of which is lost on me, certainly, which is nothing against any listeners in Birmingham, which is actually a much underrated city. But we are going to take a short break right now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Carlotta Ribello, Chris Lord and Kiara Ramella. Coming up next, should capital cities be big cities? And what now for Sean Spicer?
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Chris Lord, Carlotta Ribello and Kiara Ramella. And let's look now at Indonesia, which is wondering, as many other countries have, whether your capital and biggest city being the same city is an altogether smart idea. Indonesia is considering, not for the first time, relocating its capital to somewhere other than Jakarta, a crowded and chaotic metropolis of 10 million people. Various sites in Kalimantan, which is the Indonesian portion of Borneo, appear to be favoured. Now, Kiara Ramella, at this table has just been to Indonesia.
Jakarta?
No, she went on a plane. I was looking forward to that for so long. I was sort of expecting, I wanted the big panto musical Jakarta. But Kiara, you have just been to that. I've been looking forward to that all day and it just...
Sorry, Andrew.
Anyway, does Indonesia have a case though, Kiara? Is it asking too much of Jakarta to be the capital city and the commercial centre and everything else?
I think the issue at the heart of Jakarta is inevitably its traffic and its infrastructure, or lack thereof, and also the city's resistance to receiving some infrastructure. But I think the president needs to look at ways of improving the situation, because scrapping it and starting somewhere else would just mean leaving a city of 10 million behind and water off it. And especially it would mean creating something completely artificial, simply out of nothing. Now, Sukarno first started thinking about this in 1957 when he did build Palangkaraya in Kalimantan just for this purpose. But then the project was abandoned, and to reignite the flame now, I just don't think is feasible.
They're a weird thing, artificial capitals, and I spent some of my childhood in one, specifically Canberra, which was built to be Australia's capital to stop Sydney and Melbourne basically arguing over which of them it should be. And I've been to a couple of others, you know, Islamabad, obviously. Washington, D.C. is kind of not like that because it's the capital of the United States. But, Chris, is there something weird about places that are built to become capitals? Do they end up becoming political entities detached from the actual, you know, country that they're supposed to govern? I mean, Ankara, I know.
I was just going to say, Ankara
is not an artificial capital, but nonetheless, it's a similar thing, isn't it?
But it is. I mean, it is really an artificial capital in the sense that the only reason that the Turkish government meets there is because when the country was occupied by the Allies, that was the place that was still remained in the hands of what was once the Ottomans. That was the only bit that wasn't maintained by, wasn't in the occupation of the Allies. So yeah, when you go to Ankara, it's kind of a weird thing. It's like, you know, it's sort of a city with not many people who live there, with not a great deal of industry there, not a great deal of stuff happening at the night. Well, it's not a bad nightlife, but not great in terms of business. But then all the power is concentrated in there. And so you have this sort of strange thing where all the politicians will go to Istanbul from time to time to go and meet the people, but then they won't do anything like that in Ankara. So I think they can be strange things. When I read this story about Indonesia, though, what sort of struck me was one thing, was that, you know, this sounds like, first of all, that the Indonesian government, you know, they're conducting these reports and studies into the feasibility of this. It sounds to me like they're looking to do it. They want to do it, and they want to get the sort of justification for making that happen. Now, it does smack a bit to me of Egypt a little bit. It's as much as Sisi wants to build a new capital in Cairo because it means he doesn't have to deal with the realities of the nightmare, in many ways, of urbanism that Cairo has become. And I think that's what worries me here. I mean, I think, yeah, it's great to build a new city and to move people out and sort of try and deal with it and so on and so forth. But I think what also it basically comes down to is that they can't be bothered investing in this. And instead, they'd rather build in Borneo, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Chiara, but this city that they're sort of, this place they're looking at, it's still relatively greenfield. It's sort of, it would mean probably building on quite a bit of...
It's what they did in Canberra. The joke about which in Australia has always been that it was the ruination of a lot of otherwise perfectly good sheep pasture.
Precisely, and exactly that. And I think now if you look in the Cairo situation, one has to always be a little bit careful in any of these scenarios of how much private interest is involved in this, how much is this about a real estate thing. We can build a load more brand new buildings and we can sell them off and make them luxury things and we can make a lot of money in the process. And I think the Widodo government hasn't really shown itself to be particularly open-minded to this sort of stuff in terms of checks and balances. I think this would be another case for that, unfortunately.
With the Cairo story, I quite liked the pitch for it when the news first came out, I think last year, that it's going to have a green space twice the size of Central Park and an airport larger than Heathrow. And that's their tagline. That's what we're going to get. But it is very true. You know, with purpose-built cities, be it capitals or not in this case, you are doing a trade-off. You're trading heritage for efficiency and people don't follow you because people understand that in the end of the day, they want a place that has heritage, that has places around the city that it can connect to, be it cultural or otherwise, or be it because that's where their family was from, where they decided to establish their family roots. But when you have purpose-built cities, that is the trickiest bit. So I think it can also be what you're describing, being an excuse to try to find not to face the urbanistic issues in your city, but most of the times why it fails, in my opinion, is the lack of heritage understanding and the value that has for you. Just a tiny thing before we move on. If you want more on this, The Urbanist has done a show about purpose-built cities, which I'm sure you'll find fascinating.
Excellent plug. But finally tonight, excellent news for anyone who had July 2017 in the Sean Spicer resignation sweepstake. The hapless White House press secretary has quit, apparently outraged at the appointment as communications director of the financier Anthony Scaramucci, a man who has spent his entire life pretending to find references to Bohemian Rhapsody amusing. It is good news for Spicer's literary agent, obviously, but what else might the future hold for a 45-year-old with a considerable gift for maintaining a straight face while spouting readily disprovable nonsense? Let's remember, first of all, a few of Spicer's greatest misses.
Okay, you don't get to just yell out questions. We're going to raise our hand like big boys and girls.
Canceling the daily press briefings.
I think he's a little dismayed, as well as a lot of people, that we come out here and try to do everything we can to provide you and the American people with what he's doing on their behalf. And yet we see time and time again an attempt to parse every little word and make it more of a game of gotcha as opposed to really figure out what the policies are. If the president puts Russian salad dressing on his salad tonight, somehow that's a Russian connection. Someone as despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to the to using chemical weapons. I mean, just the other day, he sat down with Martin Luther King Jr. I would call him a civil rights leader.
His dad was the civil
third.
Rights leader.
Well, I think that...
You've had the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee.
No, actually, here's his quote, Jonathan. No, here's the direct quote. I think it's very possible, end quote. And we talked about wiretapping. He meant surveillance.
Well, so you're coming to some serious conclusions.
I think the president's tweets stand for themselves. I think there's a huge appetite for tax return, tax reform.
Have a great weekend.
Oh, it would be so much funnier if none of this was actually happening. Kiara, what do you think it is about this particular thing that has finally cracked him? This man who has been humiliated, embarrassed, set up to fail, insulted, ridiculed for 6 months. This is what sends him over the edge.
Well, Christopher Lord earlier on did remark on the fact that Anthony Scaramucci, who shares probably at some point of his lineage some heritage with my own country, Italy, had a particularly villainous name. So it's already a villainous sounding name. I think it can't be really just Scaramucci, not just a Scaramouche of Scaramucci. But I'd be interested to see if there's any kind of bigger political and underlining of the reason of the reasons why he's chosen this very moment.
That first interview is going to be a corker, isn't it? Carlotta, the thing is, Sean Spicer has ended up being thought of as a somewhat sympathetic character in that he has ended up having to go out and defend the obviously indefensible and spout obviously preposterous nonsense. But does he deserve any sympathy? He was, of course, doing this willingly.
Yeah, none from me, if I might be honest. He took the job knowing what he had to defend and who he had to defend. When not always reality matches the alternative facts. He hasn't been in the press briefing room since June 26 until this Monday. So I don't know how surprising actually is. You know, we did feel pity for him at some point. You know, one of my favorite blunders, which was very minimal in comparison to what we just heard, but when he calls Joe Trudeau from Canada, is a really good one as well. But it just shows you how not only... In the beginning, I thought it was nerves. You know, he was a nervous guy, hadn't done this job before. He would get on and be able to do it eventually. But then it's just, you're just not suited for the job. I shouldn't stay in a job that I'm not suited for. Why should he? It's as easy as that.
Well, as many members of the Trump administration have done, it is the minor service, Chris, I think they have provided in demonstrating how difficult politics actually is, and that it's not just something any Yahoo can do. Doing a job like Sean Spicer's well is actually an extremely difficult thing to do. But what does he do now, do you think, after he's sort of given his score-settling interviews and written his book, for which he will doubtless be handsomely remunerated? He's only 45.
Well, you mean what's his next job, Andrew?
Yeah.
Well, maybe head down to Venezuela, go and work for Maduro, maybe. He'd be quite a good press secretary for him, I think. No, I think it's a good point that you make, actually, about... the difficulty of this job that he's had to do. And I mean, the sort of sad case of Sean Spicer, you know, he's been mocked by Bannon for his weight. He's been mocked by Trump for his suits. He's had to defend Covfefe as having a hidden meaning. I mean, what I do wonder, I mean, you know, maybe this is pure speculation, of course, but I do wonder if, because he's kind of a bit of a fall guy, isn't he, really, for Trump? You know, Trump does
massively
various different things,
so.
And he steps out and has to sort of pick up the pieces and face this tirade of journalists in Washington.
And he can't just walk out and say, what do you want me to do? I'm working for an idiot.
And I just wonder if this is a little way to deflect things from Trump again. Maybe Trump turned around, put his hand on his shoulder and said, look, Sean, do the right thing for me. Go out there and make a bit of a show.
This is
your last show.
A last heroic hurl of his own body on the grenade.
Precisely.
But we can't forget that Trump's personal lawyer decided to abandon Trump very recently as well. So it can be that, a last hurrah for Team Trump. But it can also be, the sign of what we all can see. And it seems like no one inside that White House can. I just wonder what's going to happen now with Sean Spicer. I'm going to be looking forward. I'm just sad that Melissa McCartney is not going to happen anymore.
And that does bring us to the end of today's show. Chiara Ramella, Chris Lord, Carlotta Ribello, thanks all for joining me here at Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maya Hegard. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900, The Menu with Marcus Hippie. More on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. There'll be a lot of Sean Spicer on that, I should think. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.